The next case this morning is Gittman v. Oliver. This is case number 53225, which is also consolidated with case number 53340. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
We are. Thank you.
Mr. Eklund.
Thank you. Good morning, Justice Hardesty, Justice Sata, and Justice Perry-Gary. My name is Robert Eklund, and I have the privilege of representing the appellant in this matter. The importance of a truly impartial jury is so basic to our notion of jurisprudence that its necessity has never really been questioned in this country. This court wrote that in the Whitlock case more than two decades ago. And it is difficult to conceive of a more effective obstruction to the judicial process than a juror who has prejudiced the case. In this appeal, we are urging the court to adopt the law in Nevada to be that any prospective juror whose views might impair their ability to be fair and impartial is disqualified as a matter of law. The prospective juror cannot be rehabilitated. Prospective juror's impairment does not need to be shown with unmistakable clarity, and any doubt must be weighed by the trial judge in favor of disqualification. This court has set forth in previous cases that the purpose of voir dire in Nevada is twofold. First, to facilitate the identification and removal of potential jurors who, because of bias or prejudice, cannot serve as a fair and impartial juror. And second, for trial counsel to gather information for the intelligent exercise of peremptory challenges. Now, I took this case on appeal when Mr. Michel approached me regarding this matter because having tried now more than 100 jury trials in this jurisdiction, I am well aware that our trial counsel, both the current generation and the past, is very inconsistent on their rulings and their analysis for cause challenges in this jurisdiction. And I believe part of the problem is, as I think the court has seen from the briefs in this case, that the decisions from the Supreme Court over the last more than 100 years in this state have been inconsistent. Mr. Polzenberg cites some cases that say, contrary to our position, that more must be shown. But yet there are still four Nevada Supreme Court cases dating back to 1867 in the Fleeson case through 1995 in the Thompson case, which state the premise that we're asking for is the correct law in Nevada. So there is a split of authority that I think there needs to be some direction from this court to our trial courts. An opinion needs to be laid out instructing the trial courts on the reasons and the basic tenets and what must be shown and what the proper standard is for dismissing a juror for cause, as well as what is the prejudice standard under these circumstances. Now, the purpose of voir dire is to ferret out biases, we believe, and prejudice to create a jury panel before the exercise of peremptory strikes, free of the taint of reasonably suspected prejudice or bias. Trial courts have an obligation to strike biased and prejudiced jurors for cause. Trial courts should endeavor to secure those jurors who are not only free from, but who are not even subject to any well-grounded suspicion of any bias or prejudice. Accepting such juror statements that they can set aside their biases and be fair creates the great risk of seating biased jurors and the clear appearance of prejudice to a party. Now, what trial courts often do, many of them in this jurisdiction and others, is they seek to rehabilitate a juror who has given a potentially damaging answer reflecting a disqualifying bias or prejudice. Rehabilitation is an inaccurate term suggesting a goal of getting a juror to change the biased attitude. The better view, we feel, is that if a prospective juror makes any statement during voir dire reflecting or indicating the possibility of a disqualifying bias or prejudice, further probing into that juror's bias or attitude is required. and the trial judge should err on the side of caution by dismissing rather than trying to rehabilitate biased jurors. The trial court here should have struck Mr. Gardner for cause instead of forcing the plaintiffs to use a peremptory challenge. Here, Mr. Gardner's declaration taken as a whole makes clear that he could not state unequivocally, which is the standard in Nevada, that his preconceptions would not influence his verdict. He was adamant that his prior involvement in an accident as a defendant caused him to be biased, and he would be biased in this case. He was adamant that a lot of lawsuits are frivolous. He stated he, quote, feels pretty strongly about it, and that would play a part in me being on the jury and my decision. He was adamant that an injured plaintiff should only get compensated to fix the car, some medical bills, and a couple of days of lost work, he said, and that's all you're entitled to, period. He was adamant that an injured plaintiff should not be entitled to pain and suffering, a belief contrary to Nevada law. And under Nevada law, Mr. Gardner's alleged subsequent contradiction when questioned by defense counsel did not overcome his prior declarations as a whole. As this court said in the Thompson v. State case in 1995, simply because the district court was able to point to detached language that the juror could be impartial does not eradicate the fact that he previously demonstrated partial beliefs capped by an unequivocal statement that the defendant was guilty. And the Thompson court further explained that it may be true that on examination, the prospective juror's answers tended to contradict his previous statements, but we believe that his very self-contradiction does not increase his fitness as a juryman.
So your position here today, or that you're urging us to establish by way of opinion with respect to the four-cause challenge, would be that notwithstanding what appears to be, at least in our record, several pages of questioning going back and forth between counsel and the juror, that about the time that we have him as juror number 40 said, I do have a biased opinion of it, you would say that as a matter of law would be the end of the inquiry.
Yes. At a minimum, what should be done is the law should be that the judge should inquire further, but the judge nor the other side should attempt to rehabilitate the juror. When you say to a juror, well, putting aside all these things that you've indicated you can be biased, will you follow the instructions given you by the court and will you follow the law and apply the facts? Every juror and study after study, opinion after opinion, which we've cited, is going to say yes to the judge. That does not change the fact that they have expressed bias.
In this case, the last question to the juror number 40, but if somebody was legitimately hurt and did legitimately suffer pain, you wouldn't have any problem in those circumstances.
Well, his answer was not exactly what the defense sets forth in that in their argument here, Your Honor. He did not parrot that back, and he did not completely answer the situation and never clarified that he'd be entitled to pain and suffering. But nevertheless, that's not enough. Even if he parrots that back, this court said in Thompson that his inconsistent statements doesn't, the fact that he later retracts and says, well, yes, I guess I can do that, even though he's previously said, I don't believe in pain and suffering damages, I'm biased, it's going to affect my position in this case, that doesn't make him now, because he's said something inconsistent, appropriate. Under those circumstances, the judge should have excused him, and error should be made, the judge should err on the side of caution of dismissing these type of biased jurors. I mean, the court went on, Your Honor, to say, so would you be able to keep an open mind to listen to the facts of this case to make your decision? Mr. Gardner said, I want to say yes, but, the court says, but what? I would say no. Mr. Gardner goes on to say, yes, I would listen to the facts, but I do have a biased opinion of it, I guess, already. He said this over and over through his voir dire testimony.
And you were not out of peremptory challenges at that point, however, were you?
Well, at that point is not the issue. It's if we utilize all our peremptory challenges, which we did in this case.
Understood.
We utilized all our peremptory challenges, and I believe the better rule is set down by the case we cited, the Odell case out of the West Virginia Supreme Court, as well as what this Supreme Court said, yes, over 100 years ago in Birch v. Southern Pacific, said that under those circumstances, that is enough to show prejudice. And as I stated, it's not just the Birch case. The court said this in Thompson in 1995. All peremptory challenges had to be used. Therefore, if the defense had used one of its peremptory challenges to excuse the prospective juror, then a juror that was unacceptable to the defense would have remained on the jury. Bryant in 1956 said the same thing. State v. Teeter in 1948. This court stated, the court found that the fact that he used all of his peremptory challenges indicated he might have been dissatisfied with some juror who was unable to be challenged. So again, there is authority in this jurisdiction, and again, there is a split of authority, but I believe the better rule is that once all the peremptory challenges have been utilized, that at that point, that is enough to show prejudice. If, for example, Michelle had not used all his peremptory challenges in this case, then there might be an argument that, well, you could have used a peremptory challenge. But under this circumstance of this case, I don't believe that's the case. And even if you use the analysis argued by defendants, we still prevail because of activities of Juror Henshaw. And
Mr. Eglin, I'm going to give you an extra minute on rebuttal because I know that my colleagues and I are interested in a question that perhaps we did not give you time with our questioning, and that is we have some questions about the workers' compensation issue in this case. Could you briefly address that?
Now, Your Honor?
If I'm going to give you an extra minute on your rebuttal, your choice.
I'll do it in rebuttal, Your Honor. Thanks.
Mr. Pulsenberg.
Thank you, Justice Sato. May it please the Court. Dan Pulsenberg for respondents. I think the three issues that appellants raise in this case are exercises in jumping to conclusions. Let me start with the workers' compensation issue. The issue there, what plaintiffs say is that the judge should have given a different jury instruction under NRS 616C2110 subsection 215 subsection 10. But Judge Vega gave the exact jury instruction required under that statute. What plaintiffs are arguing now on appeal is that jury instruction should have included the amount of compensation. Now, first of all, the statute in setting out the jury instruction does not say the jury instruction should include that. Subsection 10 says that the court must receive proof. Now, there was no proof. And Judge Sato made two points. First of all, she said, the statute doesn't make an awful lot of sense, and it does seem to be contrary to the general rule of excluding collateral source. But she also pointed out there's no blank in that jury instruction to fill in the amount of compensation, that proof had to come in during trial, and nobody had proposed it during trial. The amount of workers' compensation was a court exhibit, but the court pointed out, Judge Vega pointed out, that doesn't go to the jury. So the issue isn't even, the workers' comp issue isn't even presented. And I'll go a step further to say that this, if it were an error, it's an invited error, because throughout the trial, in arguing jury instructions, plaintiffs were opposed to the amount of compensation going to the jury. On page 2086 of the transcript, Mr. Michel objects to the amount going to the jury. Mr. Michel makes the same argument that Judge Vega does, that the statute only says the jury instruction should say that the jury should not deduct. It doesn't say anything about putting in the amount. He says the amount at line 2. Judge Vega sustains at line 12, sustains plaintiff's objection, and notes that the jury instruction will be marked as defendants proposed. So it was defendants who were arguing the amount should go to the jury. It was plaintiff who said that they didn't. If it were an error, it would invite an error. Let's go to the issue that was argued here today, and that's on jury selection. If there is a trend in the law, plaintiffs are certainly bucking it. First of all, there was nothing wrong with Judge Vega's not excluding Juror Gardner for cause. Judge Baraguer, I think you hit on the exact quote. And it wasn't a question that Mr. Jaffe asked at trial. It's what what Mr. Gardner said in response to, I might say, an unintelligible question, where he said, where the juror said that he
Well, in fairness to Mr. Gardner, I think there were two intelligent questions posed, one by him and one by the other counsel. And they seem at least to be back-to-back. Plaintiff's counsel. And the reason for that is we're all different. My dad used to say that's why they make strawberry chocolate and vanilla ice cream and a flavor for everybody. Then the operative question. You believe that people shouldn't get something for pain and suffering, isn't that right? Yes. Okay, nothing further. The court. Anything further? Defendant's counsel. But if somebody was legitimately hurt and did legitimately suffer pain, you wouldn't have any problem in those circumstances. Yes. And then the judge says, I'm going to deny the challenge for cause.
Right.
It looks to me like the juror has answered the same question in two different ways.
Oh, I don't think so. And I've seen this a lot in jury selection. I think
I just had two questions. That was my first, and my second question is, when that happens, should this court require trial judges to offer a greater explanation when they deny the challenge for cause than just saying denied?
I think it was clear. The answer to your second question is no. I don't think Judge Vega had to give a greater explanation than she did. And under the circumstances, it's because it's not just those two questions. I mean, the questioning went on and on for pages, as Justice Perigary points out. You can't go to one question. You can't say where Mr. Gardner ad-libbed and says, I suppose I have a bias, because he doesn't know the legal meaning of bias. He may just mean a point of view. He just may mean an inclination, and we don't disqualify people for points of view. What he said repeatedly throughout the jury selection was, and here he says on page 1056, if somebody would, first of all, here's what I've seen a lot in jury selection, where prospective jurors have come in and said, I think there are too many frivolous lawsuits, and I think people should just get their medical bills paid, and they shouldn't get anything else than that. And then when it's explained to them what the law is, and when it's explained to them that not all cases are frivolous, then they say, okay, I can follow those instructions. I've had the same incident where I'm in trial and Mr. Eglitz on the other side, and we have prospective jurors who say they think there are too many frivolous lawsuits, and yet Mr. Eglitz wins millions of dollars at trial. Because once juries hear the evidence, they make determinations of the individual case in front of them. Mr. Gardner said, if somebody was legitimately hurt, now obviously here in his answer, these are his words, he's not being led. He's worried about whether people have legitimate claims, and the legitimacy of this claim was in question. If somebody was legitimately hurt, obviously it wasn't their fault, and for some reason they couldn't work anymore, then I would say yes. I mean, as far as a cash settlement of some kind, I would say that they're entitled to that. And Mr. Jaffe and Mr. Gardner go back and forth on that. It is clear to me, and I think clear to Judge Vega, that under those circumstances, this is not a prospective juror who has the kind of legal bias that can keep the person from hearing the case. And even if it were an error, and I don't think it is an error, but even if it were an error, it would be a harmless error. Mr. Eglitz points out that all the peremptory challenges were exhausted. And I do appreciate Mr. Eglitz on appeal, because he tends to be forthright on things. And he says things more accurately than their brief does. Their brief says that they used their last peremptory challenge on this. No. On page 273 of the appendix, it is clear that they used their second peremptory challenge on Mr. Gardner. They had no other challenges for cause. They were not faced with jurors on the jury whom they had challenged for cause and ran out of peremptory challenges. Now they had, Mr. Gardner would have been an alternate, probably the second alternate if he weren't challenged. They used their second challenge instead of their fifth on him. They don't come in and explain why they couldn't have used one of their other four challenges on this. They point out that they used one for Joanna Henshaw, but they don't talk about the other three. And the wave of the law in the United States Supreme Court case of 2000 in United States versus Martina Salazar is that you have not made a case for challenging the denial of a for-cause challenge unless somebody was sitting on that jury to whom you had objected because with the for-cause challenge. And, you know, that is not that much different from what this court said in Birch versus Southern Pacific. And it was dicta, and it was 1909. But what it's saying is that if there had been error in the judge denying the for-cause challenge, that there would be reversible error if there was an objectionable jury that was seated. There was no objectionable jury. Plaintiffs did not object to the jury as seated, did not object to Ms. Henshaw for cause in multiple opportunities to do so. The situation simply is not presented. So I would say those two situations, you can see where the issue isn't even presented to this court. Let me just briefly address the third issue as well, and that issue is having the case go to the jury at 8:38 in the evening. There was no objection to this. This is not, and there have been much publicity about this kind of issue, but this isn't that type of situation. Their brief says that this went to the jury the Friday before a holiday weekend. That's not true. It went to the jury on a Monday. It was before the one-day holiday for Veterans Day. But there was no objection. There was no indication from the jury that they were tired and wanted to go home. Plaintiffs did not object. The jury even had a request to play a video back to them. And so they weren't in a situation where they were hurrying. And all the cases cited by plaintiff have to do with dynamite charges, Allen charges, where you have a deadlocked jury and they can't come to a decision. And it is inappropriate in some circumstances for the judge to coerce a verdict. But that didn't happen here, and none of those issues are presented. So on the jury issue, and I'm going to let Mr. Jaffe talk about the weight of the evidence in just a second, but on the jury issue, if you look at all the pages, if you look at the entire issue presented to the judge saw a situation here where she took a jury outside the presence of the other jurors because she thought it may be an issue. She allowed additional questioning. The questioning came from Mr. Jaffe, not from the court, so it's not the situation that we see in the other cases where the court asks a magic question, can you be fair? We have really detailed questioning and detailed answering where the prospective juror says, yes, if there's a legitimate injury, I have no problem with general damages. And the cases that they cite, Odell was a case from West Virginia, but Odell was a case where the prospective juror had saw the same doc. And the Alsop case from the Ninth Circuit is where two of the jurors who were put on the jury panel were employees of the bank that was robbed. There are some objective situations where the district court cannot rehabilitate. But just an inclination stated by a prospective juror that I think there are too many lawsuits, I think there are too many frivolous lawsuits, are situations that can be handled on question. If there are no questions from the court, I'd like to have Mr. Jaffe address the evidence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Jaffe.
Good morning, and thank you, Justice Sater. Good morning, Justice Hardesty, Justice Paragary. Very briefly, the evidence supported the verdict in this case. The jury heard different testimony from two experts, one the treating orthopedic surgeon, one a highly credentialed neurosurgeon. Dr. Lawrence Marshall, called by the defense, testified for the jury that the plaintiff had significant pre-existing disease. He had absolutely no need for an emergent surgery, and he was not a credible patient, and that the accident did not cause the need for surgery that the accident did not cause the disc problems. The jury heard that explained at length by Dr. Marshall with the basis for that as he went through the MRIs, medical records, as well as his basis for not finding the plaintiff credible, given the fact that his findings during an exam did not anatomically match up with the biology. During cross-examination of Dr. Jaswinder Grover, the treating orthopedic surgeon, he conceded actually several of these points at different stages throughout. For example, he testified that the plaintiff's distraction testing, which differed from his testing under actual examination, meaning when he was distracted, he moved much better than he did when being prompted as part of the direct portion of the exam, was an indication, and somebody could legitimately conclude that he voluntarily or involuntarily altered the test results to his favor. Dr. Grover further conceded that the reason for surgery being performed was based upon the need to take pressure off the spine and stabilize it. He did not mention anything about pain and suffering. He agreed that the instability was caused by pre-existing degeneration, meaning bad discs that predated this accident for several years, as well as bone spurs formed as a result of the body's response to the bad discs, meaning that the body itself was trying to heal itself for upwards of several years and no less than 6 months before this accident, and that the instability, meaning that bad disc, that bony formation, is what prompted the need for the surgery, not the accident. So in many respects, Dr. Grover agreed with Dr. Marshall in that respect. Therefore, there was a legitimate basis for the jury to exclude that the surgery was in any way causally related to the accident, and the jury's verdict was a sound one supported by evidence presented during the course of the trial. I have nothing further to add unless the panel has any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jaffe.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Eglin.
Thank you. If I may address Mr. Polzenberg's response to the argument I get, and then I'll get to the question, Your Honor. First of all, as the court is aware, it's the declarations as a whole of the juror, and you can't point to detached language that the juror could be impartial, and that doesn't eradicate the fact that the juror or prospective juror previously demonstrated beliefs showing bias. That's the law in Nevada. That is the law. So you can't go back and have this magic question, whether it's from the judge or whether from its opposing counsel, it doesn't matter. And in this case, Mr. Polzenberg is incorrect about the questions from the judge from outside the presence of the rest of the panel. These are the questions from the judge, and these are Mr. Gardner's answers. Will you be able to set aside your own personal situation and listen to the evidence in this case to make your decision here if you're selected to serve? No. He says no, unequivocally. She then asked, so would you be able to keep an open mind to listen to the facts of this case to make your decision? I want to say yes, but the court, but what? I would say no, no. The question that is asked, so the court is clear, by, or that's repeated back, Mr. Gardner said, if somebody, and the question is focusing on pain and suffering damages. That's what Mr. Jaffe is asking. And Mr. Carter's response to that doesn't mention pain and suffering damages, doesn't say he'd be willing to consider pain and suffering damages. He says, if somebody was legitimately hurt, obviously it wasn't their fault, and for some reason they couldn't work anymore, then I would say yes. I mean, as far as a cash settlement of some kind, I would say they're entitled to that. So he never actually comes back and equivocates, even Mr. Gardner, that he, you know, he would be okay with pain and suffering damages. That's just incorrect. Let me just correct an error. This is Court's Exhibit. This is part of the record. Court's Exhibit number one, which is the peremptory challenge sheet. It's in the record. It had four peremptory challenges for jurors and then one peremptory challenge for each side for the alternates. Mr. Gardner was not an alternate. Mr. Gardner was seated up here in seat number two in this chart. So I understand because the court record, when the court read back the jurors that were excused and he was one of the people toward the end's names he read, it was confused. But he was not an alternate, was not in an alternate seat in this case. So that's just an incorrect statement.
The panel as a whole was passed for cause. There were no other challenges for cause.
Well, and you're correct, but that's not the end of the story. A jury can challenge cause at any time during the trial. Ms. Henshaw was a disruption in this trial.
a note was passed by one of the jurors to the judge who said that she was out there with other jurors talking about the case, prejudging the case, and was becoming a problem, not following the judge's instructions. In fact, she was talking with one of the jurors during one of the examinations of the witnesses. The judge actually had to admonish her and the other juror to be quiet. And then when the judge received this note, she again admonished the juror. At the sidebar, at the side bench at that time, Mr. Bushell asked that she be excused for cause. That motion was denied. That request was denied by the court. And the case law in Nevada and other jurisdictions clearly states that it doesn't have to be just during voir dire. If a basis for cause occurs during the trial, that juror should have been excused at that point. She wasn't. So we did have a biased juror sitting on this panel.
That was based on misconduct as opposed to anything else.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Right.
A biased juror is a biased juror, whether it's misconduct or what they've stated, in the voir dire. And that's the situation we have here. But, Your Honor, even assuming, Justice Perry-Gary, that we accept defendant's situation, we have the situation here where their analysis of these cases, we have a situation here where we did have a biased juror, Ms. Henshaw, on this panel. And that distinguishes this case from the Martinez-Salazar case, where the U.S. Supreme Court said, importantly, the court noted that this case did not involve an issue of an erroneous ruling that resulted in the seating of a juror who should have been dismissed for cause. That circumstance would require reversal. That's what we have here with Ms. Henshaw. And I know the court has a question for me on the issue of...
We'll give you 1 minute to respond to the workers' compensation question, most specifically what Mr. Polsenberg stated.
Well, first of all, the Nevada Supreme Court in Kramer versus Peavy has said that the jury must receive, not may receive, must receive proof of all payments made by the workers' compensation carrier. That clearly states in the case it's the amount of the payments. And in the judiciary hearings regarding this NRS statute, they stated it was enacted so the jury could return a more informed decision. Not informing the jury of the amount of the work comp lien leads to confusion and speculation by the jury, as reflected in the legislative record cited in our opening brief.
Well, who objected to the amount being sent back to the jury?
Well, Mr. Michelle objected on other bases. What he objected to was based on the court's pretrial ruling on the collateral source argument, was that counsel for the defense cannot argue to the jury that this is a double recovery, that he's already been paid by work comp and therefore he shouldn't be able to be compensated again by the amount. I don't believe the record reflects that Mr. Michelle specifically objected to the amount being sent back to or being presented to the jury.
The workers' comp instruction was indicated as a defense instruction.
Well, yeah, the workers' comp instruction was a defense instruction, but that whether it's a defense instruction or plaintiff's instruction makes no difference. Under the Kramer-Perry Court case, the court has an obligation to make sure it's a must. It's not a may. Must be informed of this. And so we would argue that it is an error of law by the court by not including it in there. And I think the record clearly shows that the trial judge was confused about by this. She states right in the record, this is the first time I've ever addressed this issue or had this issue come up.
Other questions?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Eglett.
Thank you.
This case will stand submitted. Mr. Eglett, Mr. Polsenberg, Mr. Jaffe, thank you for your fine arguments here today.